thinking that I'd encourage people to continue reflecting on different aspects of this gradual path. You know, so often meditation and practice and Buddhist practice can end up very technique-oriented, and I think it's important to recognize how much the basic principles not only just lay a foundation for practice, but carry one through the practice. You know, thinking back on my time with Ajahn Chah, you know, the vast majority of the teachings would end up being around very simple themes. Eat little, sleep little, speak little, practice a lot. You know, and that was enough. That certainly kept us busy. Yeah. Just trying to figure out how to deal with those basic pulls in the mind both to desire that just kind of some kind of stimulation, some kind of excitement, anything in my mind, and or the tendencies to aversion. But then, you know, we get tired of that, so then we try to annihilate it in some way, shape, or form. Just let me go to sleep and forget about it. Or, you know, we distract ourselves with conversation, stir ourselves up, and all the different, I mean, it's sort of speak little, but then it's, you know, that extends itself out to all the different ways which we communicate or receive communication. It's the all the different forms of media that we're plugged into, and I wonder why we're agitated and restless and disturbed a lot of the time. So that simple, eat little, sleep little, speak little, practice a lot is really a crucial part of laying a really solid foundation for ourselves in practice. It also reminds me of a story that I heard, might have been second, third hand, or fourth hand by then, but it's about Master Xuanhua, the abbot of City of 10,000 Buddhas, and it took place at his Gold Mountain Monastery in San Francisco. But it was a well-known professor of Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist studies, came to visit Master Hua, and he had contacted and asked if he could be able to question Master Hua about some of the refined details of the Avatamsaka Sutta, Flower Adornment Sutta, which is a very important text in the Mahayana tradition. And anyway, he showed up and started speaking with Master Hua and explaining where his questions come from and his doubts and his uncertainties and his wanting to gain more understanding and of the sutta and some. And so then he was began asking various questions, and many of them were quite abstruse aspects of philosophical speculation. And after not very long at all, Master Hua, I sort of asked, "Why are you so overweight? How many times a day are you eating?" And this is the professor's kind of rattled, and then sort of charges on and so it's asking one more, you know, sort of philosophical questions, and so what time do you get up in the morning? You know, how much do you sleep at night? It was, again, it's a rebel. And then it goes on for a bit. It sort of charges on. It's a pretty intrepid character or anything. Yeah, Master Hoss, everything. So. You're married, aren't you? Do you still look at other women with sexual desire? This poor professor but it was really important because you can discuss philosophy and have all sorts of knowledge of the different schools of Buddhism and whatnot, but you know, it comes back. Eat little, sleep little, speak little. And just how to come back. How do we do that? And what are the... And we can't do that just by an issue of control. I'm just going to force myself to be controlled and mindful. We have to really investigate, pay attention what are the obstacles. And of course, we lift up the practices of mindfulness, clear comprehension, develop the four foundations of mindfulness, use that as a structure, but we also have to, we can't just sort of force the mind into some ideal that we think it should be. We have to be alert to what are the obstacles that arise. And this is where paying attention to the five hindrances is an important basis. And the five hindrances, sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, skeptical doubt. Those are kind of pretty fundamental ways that the mind goes to, one, to create suffering or create agitation within the mind, or it's an expression of dukkha, because oftentimes there's a sort of dukkha. What dukkha? But we're either restless or worried about something, or we're trying to distract ourselves in some way. But they're an expression of dukkha. But they're also, they're really a, on a certain level, they're kind of a strategy. We experience some kind of dukkha. We don't understand it. We don't see it clearly. And then it comes out. It's like a strategy to get out of the particular dukkha that might be kind of unnamed, unformed, not very clear. But then it comes out in, say, sense desire, irritation, ill will. And then it's a strategy. The mind goes there to kind of, it seems quite rational to get really irritated by some idiot. But it's not a really useful strategy. So recognize, those are hindrances, and to be able to see how they're coming up, how they're forming, what's the fuel behind them, what's the result. There's a discourse in the I expect it's in the Nidana Sanghita, the connected discourses, and on the section on dependent origination. And it starts with, say, avijja, ignorance, mental formations, consciousness, with this as a causal formations, dependently arisen phenomena, and of course leading to dukkha. But it always seems to start with avijja. And of course, the feeling or the assumption might be that, we just are in this sort of primal swamp of avijja, and there's no kind of there's no alternative. But then there are discourse, and in this particular discourse I'm thinking, the Buddha points to the fact that say, not only are all these other conditions, there's these sequences of conditionality, but then avijja is conditioned. And what is the underlying, condition for avijja, and then five hindrances. So it's a you realize that okay, we're actually feeding and supporting that avijja. And of course, then the Buddha draws it back in different ways of how just not hearing true Dhamma, things like that, are building up to a place of hindrances. These areas of conditionality, but that direct link between the hindrances and that nourishing, nurturing of underlying root of ignorance or avijja is more lack of true knowledge. So that the lifting up of the five hindrances as an object of contemplation is not, it's not a small thing. It's not just something that one does the first 5 or 10 minutes of your meditation, get those hindrances out of the way so then you can just sort of dive into deep samadhi. This is a real learning process of how does the mind work? What is it that feeds our roots of the process of dukkha, and what is it that helps to feed and nourish the way out of dukkha? So that cultivation of contemplation or attending to these hindrances, it's sort of like you're tagging it and recognizing what's coming up in the mind. It doesn't mean you have to obsess with it and me and my sloth and torpor. You recognize, okay, that's what's arising. How do I work with it? What skillful means can I bring to this to nourish really wholesome qualities? Because, the mind will settle when we are able to, relinquish unwholesome qualities, unskillful qualities, akusala dhammas, and there's a continuity of the skillful, of the wholesome. That's the natural order of things. In the same way that if you walk outside and it's raining, chances are you're going to get wet. It's in the natural order of things. So that if you, in the natural order of things, if you relinquish the unwholesome, unskillful, pay attention, nourish and nurture the wholesome, the skillful, mind becomes peaceful and settled, becomes clear and bright. It's a natural result. So then, in paying attention to these hindrances, just to recognize, okay, there's sensual desire, sensory desire, the mind looking for some object of interest, some object of stimulation, not just interest in terms of what are its characteristics and how can I be liberated from this. More like, oh, what can I get out of this? It's more, what's going to be? How can I get my hit of pleasure out of this somehow? So that is a sensual desire, recognizing those tendencies, and one of the images that the Buddha gives of sensual desire is just of the and he's giving a Dhamma talk in one of some hall. There's oil lamps lit, And then the insects coming, and it's in the evening time, insects coming and flying into the flame. And the Buddha sort of comparing that human beings do the same thing with, say, with sensual desire. It's like that insect attracted to the light, but then is burnt by it. And say, it's a very similar dynamic where we're pulled to something that is you know, it's that's where my happiness is going to be. That's where I'm going to be satisfied. That's what I really want. And then we end up, what the heck was I even thinking about? Later, when we sort of feel the repercussions of that. So that being able to pay attention to sense desire, in the sense that, you know, the feeling with desire is that if I don't get it, I'm going to be missing something. And then, you know, you don't want to miss something. You don't want to miss out on that. So then you go for it. But then, you know, you start contemplating it and you realize, well, actually, before that desire arose, I wasn't missing anything anyway. So it's just we've conjured it up in the mind and we've run after it. And then we run around following it. So it's not a satisfying strategy. Being able to be alert, attentive to that, and it doesn't mean you can't ever have anything or experience something pleasurable. But do we have to be driven by desire? Can we approach our senses and sense experience in the world with some clarity and some steadiness, stability? Oftentimes people worry that they'll never be able to experience anything beautiful again. What about beauty in nature? And there's a very beautiful description of the Buddha going to. It's in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, where it's the last months of the Buddha's life, and he's just leaving. He's taught the monastic community, lay community in Vaisali, and then he and Ananda are leaving Vaisali, and there's a little rise coming out of the city, and he turns around and looks back at Vaisali and says, you know, Vaisali is a really beautiful place with its parks and its fountains and all of that. And he said, you know, and that's the last time I'll see it. And turns around and goes. And sort of like acknowledging that beauty, and by then also acknowledging that the fact that whatever, however beautiful it is, it has to be relinquished, because he'd already said he was going to be passing away at such and such a time, so he knew he wasn't going to be coming back. So quite a poignant. Also, just many of the in the Theragatha and Therigatha verses of the poems and songs of the elder monks and nuns, there's many expressions of speaking to the beauty of the surroundings or nature. And curiously, one of the probably the most gushy poems or songs are from Mahakasapa, who's kind of viewed as the austere ascetic in the Theravada tradition, but his reflecting on the nature around him is really very beautiful. So, in just recognizing that, say, the hindrance of sense desire, sensual desire, that need for gratification, stimulation, and how it puts the mind on edge. It sort of increases suffering. Ill will, similar, that as much as we can have all the good reasons to be upset about something, the feeling is one of agitation and dukkha, and there isn't clarity there when we're that invested in being averse and upset at something. So it puts us at a huge disadvantage just in terms of day-to-day life, but then also in terms of settling the mind, making the mind peaceful for meditation, so that and sometimes when we say we come into a retreat or when we're meditating on our daily basis, those are the times that the things that were sort of mildly irritating during the day, they come back to haunt us. And if we don't have, if we're not, don't deal with it skillfully, then the mind settles down and it can hone in on that and get more and more upset. So recognize, oh, this is a hindrance. This is an obstacle. It obscures awareness and weakens discernment, weakens wisdom. So then, okay, it needs to be dealt with in some way, shape, or form. And the just the strategies of sometimes replacing that train of thought in the mind with lifting up, generating a loving kindness is a skillful way of just not giving attention to the and it's not just a sort of a glossing over. It's a conscious strategy, conscious recognition. This been there, done that. I know where this is going. Let's try something different, and lifting up that cultivation of a more bright state of mind. Also one of the things with, say, as a hindrance to be, say, paying attention to, well, what is it that is being, because oftentimes why we experience ill will is because something has been thwarted of ours, in terms of whether it's a desire, a preference, an idea, an opinion. When that's been thwarted or challenged, then we respond with ill will. So to be able to pay attention, what's being thwarted? Where is the resistance? So rather than going to the object of our aversion, coming back and saying, where is it coming from in my own mind? What is it? What would I need to relinquish or give up if I don't want to kind of pickle in my ill will? So it's a skillful way of relinquishing. Sloth and torpor. These are just the way that the mind goes to dullness, lassitude, drifts, gets kind of amorphous, especially in meditation. It's really important, especially on a retreat, it's really important to recognize this as a hindrance, because there's a certain pleasantness as one is sort of sitting there drifting, and you know, at least it's, you know, it's not kind of extreme suffering, but it's not a really good mental space for understanding. So that being alert to the, when does the mind start to drift? What am I actually paying attention to? Or what am I trying to pay attention to? And what's the object of my mind before I started drifting off? Because that's important, because sometimes we keep doing the same thing over and over again, and it keeps bringing us to the same place of, say, either whatever. But this, in this case, with sloth and torpor. So sometimes with our meditation, you know, we want to be peaceful, we want to simplify the mind. So then we're just sitting with something soothing, like the breath coming in, the breath going out, and you know, it really soothes one to sleep, or to, if not overt sleep, then just kind of drifting. And it doesn't mean we have to, say, relinquish the breath completely, but it's important that we give the mind enough work to do that it can engage with the object of meditation. And that's really important. Sometimes one can switch the object around, but even if one stays with, say, staying with the breath, but then adding butho, on the in-breath, butho, just to give the mind some work to do. Paying attention rather than just settling into the rhythm of the breath, paying attention to that initial sensation as the breath comes in, making it clear what does it feel like as it comes into the chest, what's it feel like as it comes down to the abdomen, really making that clear, that initial feeling of as the breath goes out, what's that initial contact as the breath goes out, and so that the one's having to sharpen one's awareness in order to stay with the object that you've added a layer of complexity, but that complexity helps the mind be present. You are adding a bit more work for it to do, because if there's not enough work for the mind, it wants to go on vacation. So you need to engage the mind in a balanced way. It's just enough. I mean, sometimes we try to do too much and it just agitates the mind, which is where, restlessness comes in. That's where the Buddha, when the mind is restless, teaching on the seven factors of awakening, you know, when the mind is restless, don't direct attention to the more active aspects of those factors of awakening. That analysis of dhammas, dhamma vicaya, analysis of states, investigations of dhamma, effort, energy, rapture, joy, those will stir up the mind even more. You have to direct attention to the more settling side of the equation. That's that tranquility, the settledness of the mind, equanimity. Those are the qualities. When the mind is restless, then we need to direct more conscious attention to that aspect of the path. And it helps to balance, helps to settle that restlessness. Skeptical doubt is another hindrance, and that hindrance is where one is wavering, uncertain, then one should try to direct one's attention to something that, say, that gives one some confidence or some kind of feeling of, you know, a bit more certainty, or and all of these elements of the practicing and directing attention with the learning how to direct attention to a pleasing object or a satisfying object, inspiring object, is really important, particularly with doubt. But it applies with all of the hindrances in the same thing. When the mind starts to get agitated or stirred up in some way, shape, or form, then lifting up a pleasing object. There's a discourse where Ananda is visiting the nuns' quarters and speaking with the nuns, and they're saying, you know, the nuns are intent on their cultivation of the four foundations of mindfulness, and they're, you know, gaining understanding and progress in practice. And then Ananda sort of gives his kind of encouragement. He goes back to the Buddha. He relates it to the Buddha, and the Buddha sort of similarity. He sort of says, yeah, great. And so that's how it works. When you do the practice, we say, cultivate those four foundations of mindfulness, then those hindrances, the objects of that tend to disturb the mind, will dissipate. And he said, and, you know, sometimes when they say that in practice, when the sort of the object of mind, you know, is something tangible or that is obsessing, or there's some, you know, sort of stimulating of desire in terms of something physical, or there's some kind of bodily distress and some kind of painful, uncomfortable sensation stirs up the mind, or there's some mental kind of obsession in some way, and the Buddha said to direct attention to a pleasing object. And the word that he uses is pasadaniya nimitta. So nimitta is a sign or an image, and pasadaniya is something that both inspires confidence, and one of the reasons, of course, why it caught my attention is because it's the same root as my own name, Pasanno and Pasadniya. It's sort of this something that is a faith and joy, those two together. So something that encourages confidence and well-being. So that lifting up an image in the mind, an object of attention, that encourages that sense of confidence, of faith, of well-being. And so then, you know, when one does that, then you know, one will feel a sense of ease. There'll be a sense of ease in physically. Once when there's a physical ease, then there'll be a sense of well-being. You know, well-being will give a sense of joy. Joy, there's going to be pleasure, contentment, and then the mind becomes easily concentrated, easily settled. And so, as the mind becomes settled, then there's a reflection and acknowledgement, understanding. Mindfulness is present, and I am content. It's really beautiful. So that to be able to, these are you're consciously paying attention to the objects that are, say, disturbing, the hindrances, but then also lifting up things that are settling for the mind, soothing for the mind, encourage the mind, and it has an effect. And to be able to to pay attention to that and to nurture that process. It's something that we engage in, as opposed to, you know, if I just sit here long enough, it's something's going to happen. It's sort of kind of the waiting for Godot kind of. Being proactive, but being balanced in that. You know, you just need to recognize that the mind responds to input on both sides of the equation, so that the hindrances have a certain effect, but then that directing attention to something that is, say, that is pleasing, that is settling, that has effect as well. And to be able to own it, take responsibility for it, and realize that this is not it's not rocket science. This is just paying attention to your own experience and looking out for what is really in your best interest. So we can work with that, pay attention to that, see where that goes. We can just sit quietly for a little bit longer and do some walking.